This is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Sam Sanders, sitting in for Shumita Basu. Today, how social media is creating a plastic surgery frenzy. Feels like, to me at least, that our culture has never been more obsessed with how we look than now. But in reality, humans have always cared a lot about that kind of stuff. Ancient Greeks developed these specific ideals for face and body proportions long before mirrors were invented, or fashion magazines, or the internet. But this obsession has recently taken on new forms. Dr. Neelam Vashi knows all about this. She's a dermatologist and the director of the Boston University Cosmetic and Laser Center. She began practicing cosmetic surgery 12 years ago.
You know, when I started several years ago, people would bring in photographs of celebrities.
People wanted Scarlett Johansson lips, or a Halle Berry jawline, or Angelina Jolie cheekbones. But in recent years, Dr. Vashi's patients began to bring in something different. Photos of themselves put through some kind of filter. A filter that can make your skin look smooth, or get rid of wrinkles, or make your eyes look bigger, your lips fuller. Filters coming from the apps right on our phones.
They were using Snapchat, Facetune, Lightroom, Snapseed. It becomes much harder to give someone a realistic expectation when they're bringing in a glorified, beautified image of themselves.
Sometimes what they're chasing, it's just not possible.
And I'll say, I can't do this with a clear conscience because I don't think you will be happy with the outcome. And you can never go back once you do something.
From filters to the content being fed to us by our social media algorithms to how much we look at ourselves every day on Zoom, we are constantly being asked to tweak our faces and our bodies. This is changing our beauty standards in drastic and rapid ways. And the cosmetic procedures to get all this done, those have never been more accessible. So, more people, men, women, young, old, more people are making major changes to their appearance. And they're chasing beauty standards that might shift again in just a few years. A bit later, I'll talk to journalist and author Elise Hu about her book on beauty culture in South Korea, the world capital of cosmetic surgery. But first, more with Dr. Vashi. She actually just published a study that examines the connection between social media use and cosmetic procedures.
We started it in 2018, 2019, and then COVID happened. So what we did in the study was we were able to just look at it globally. What are the factors that lead to people desiring more cosmetic procedures? And then also we were able to see what did COVID do, and we were able to separate groups out into a pre- and post-pandemic.
Really? What was the big finding from this study you did?
So the big overall finding is that social media is clearly a determinant in the desire to have a cosmetic procedure. And what's really influencing is people who are using more photo editing and filters have more of this desire to pursue cosmetic treatments.
Really?
And then also following accounts of celebrities, influencers, and just social media accounts that showed cosmetic results.
So the more you use a filter on your face in a random social media app, the more likely you are to want a cosmetic procedure?
Yes. And so that was overall, that was globally. Now, when we looked at the pre and post COVID groups, COVID was just life-changing. Clearly, it was a pandemic. There was isolation. And there was this huge, very fast push towards video conferencing, Zoom.
And also, people forget, at the height of that first lockdown, that's when TikTok took off.
Yeah.
Because we were all at home and had time to make those videos.
We had time to make videos. We had time to take photos. And we had time to do a lot of things online. So when that happened, we found that there were more people who had thought about having a cosmetic procedure done and actually gone the extra step and had discussed it with a physician, a dermatologist, a plastic surgeon. And then also, and lastly, and I think this is very important, more in the post-COVID group, they believe that a cosmetic procedure would help their self-esteem.
I mean, I hear you say it. I don't think I'm surprised, but that makes me a little sad. As the person who led this study, how do the results make you feel as an individual?
So I've written a lot about this. I call social media a necessary evil. It can do great things. It can bring people together. We can communicate. But there's also a lot of negativity that comes with it. And there's a lot of studies that show it leads to depression, anxiety. There's this comparison of looks that can make people feel really bad. It can lead to body image dissatisfaction. And then when people are using filters and editing, there's many more dynamics at play. So firstly, there's a comparison to others. There's the social standards. But then there's also a comparison to oneself.
Which is scary.
Exactly.
It's like now I can see my face in a mirror and be like, okay, you look decent, Sam. But then I see my little filtered face and there's this, I almost feel like I always want to look like that, but you can't always look like that because it's literally a computer tweaking your face.
Exactly. And that's what becomes so difficult in my practice.
Have the demographics of your dermatology clients shifted as, let's call it, filter culture has become ascendant? Have they gotten younger? Is it more men than women? Like, has there been a shift?
It's just been more.
Really?
We see that, yeah. And that's why my study, like, supports some other studies that are out there that we just have seen an increase in people wanting cosmetic procedures. Yes, I have younger patients now than 10 years ago coming in for injectables like Botox and other types of cosmetic procedures. But I also have older patients who may not have thought about this. I have older women who come in who still work and they see themselves on the screen and don't like the way they look. They don't like how they're interacting. So the constant viewing of oneself has pushed people to pursue cosmetic procedures.
There's another piece to this. How fast it's all happening. Classic representations of beauty that have been true for decades, they're now changing in a matter of years. According to the American Society of Plastic Surgeons, butt lifts increased by 256% between 2000 and 2018. Another example are lips. For centuries, Western culture has believed that lips looked most beautiful in a 1 to 1.6 ratio. That means the bottom lip is bigger than the top lip, 1.6 times bigger. This is called the golden ratio, and it goes all the way back to Renaissance paintings and ancient Greek sculptures. But in just about 5 years, Dr. Vashi says that golden ratio has changed. And you can see it all over Instagram.
I had noticed that people were actually coming into clinic wanting it much more of the same, like a 1-to-1 ratio. And I found that really interesting. So I was like, well, let's just look at this on a more global scale. So what we did was we actually looked at Instagram, just looking at lip size. And what we found was the ratio had shifted towards that 1-to-1.
That aspirational symmetry we've all wanted for centuries, social media has upended it in just a few years.
And that's why social media is so concerning. This kind of brings us to what is probably the most important aspect of defining beauty. We as humans, we have amazing processing systems in our minds. We can look at someone in 100 milliseconds, blink of an eye, and we will be able to say if that person's beautiful or not. We won't remember their hair color, their eye color, what ethnicity they were. We won't be able to name those things, but we'll be like, they're beautiful. And the most important aspect of beauty is this concept of averageness. Now, averageness is actually not looking average at all. But what it is, it's this universal standard of beauty, and it's the most important objective aspect in determining facial attractiveness. And it refers to how closely a face resembles the majority of faces within a population. So our population could be me giving a talk to 100 people. Our population could be me looking at 1,000 images. Mm-hmm. What my brain does is it looks at all of them, and then it makes a prototype in my head. And we define beauty as how then closely
we are to that.
Yeah, or what we're looking at
close to that.
When I was growing up, it was magazines, Vogue, Bazaar, People. And you see these beautiful people, and that becomes this prototype of what's beautiful. So we see our world around us and then these beautiful people. Now we have social media and we spend a lot of time on it. And so that's why it's so fast, because now we're processing all these images. We're making a prototype much faster than we did years before.
And we're making a prototype that includes digitally altered faces.
Exactly. So, and this is, again, another fascinating study. So what they did was they looked at kids like 8 years old, and they did a beauty study. They, and the children rated facial beauty. Mm-hmm. Then they showed them storybooks. And what they did was they distorted the faces. They made them squished or wide. And they showed them all these different storybooks. Then they gave them another beauty survey. And what they found was that what these children found beautiful shifted towards the distortion. It didn't become the distortion, but it shifted.
Really?
Because what had happened was when they were given those storybooks, they formed a new prototype.
So you're saying that our perception of beauty is actually quite malleable.
Exactly. I actually started looking at how things are evolving and changing. And what we did is we looked at, you know, People magazine always has that 50 most beautiful people, 100 most. Yeah. So we looked at that and we looked at the ethnicities and the ages of the beautiful people and we compared it. So from the inaugural issue in 1990 to 2017. And what we found was it was more diverse and older. So in 1990, darker skin tones was only 12%, but in 2017, it was 30%.
Well, all right.
And then people were also older. In 1990, the average age was 33 of the most beautiful people. In 2017, was 39.
As a 39-year-old Black man, I'm overjoyed. I'm pumping my fist in the studio. I can still be pretty.
Very pretty. Most beautiful.
So this is interesting to me because I feel like culture teaches us that beauty is set. This is aspirational beauty. You look like that. You look like this. Bam. But what you're saying is our perception of what's beautiful can shift as the things we see shift. And what's happening with social media is that we're just seeing so many more faces and so many more altered faces. And that's obviously going to shift what we perceive to be beautiful.
Exactly. And when I was first doing this, I was really set that these are the objective aspects of beauty, and it's symmetry, youthfulness, this concept of averageness, and then skin homogeneity. And now I've realized that even these very objective aspects, they seem so set, but it's not the case. We have the ability to change it, and we can see the change.
If you're wondering where all of this could be headed, look to South Korea. That country has the highest per capita rate of cosmetic surgery in the world.
They say that the future has already arrived, it's just not evenly distributed. And so South Korea is a kind of harbinger of things to come.
That's Elise Hu. She's the author of the book Flawless: Lessons in Looks and Culture from the K-Beauty Capital. Elise spent several years as NPR's bureau chief in Seoul, South Korea. And she saw firsthand just how normalized cosmetic surgery had become there.
Korean health ministry data shows that 53% of college-age girls in Korea say that they have already had some kind of work done.
Elise says there are two big reasons for this. One, Korea has some of the fastest internet in the world, and it's available to everyone in the country, which means it's been quicker to some of these social media trends than, say, the U.S. And two, it's a lot cheaper and easier to get cosmetic surgery there.
I'm looking at Korea as an interesting place, but not judging it or saying like, oh, look at you, how weird, you know, because this is actually happening to all of us.
We're all going through
right?
it. Right. Yeah.
Korea just kind of got there first because it's technologically advanced.
Yeah.
And so it's worth studying.
They had the infrastructure for it
right.
first.
Right. They had the infrastructure for it first and then continued to export the ideas that they can improve your skin and face and body. But it's happening everywhere. I don't think that we're better off here in the U.S. I do think it's more expensive.
Really?
So it's more expensive to get plastic surgery, to get the injectables, to get the fillers. And so for now, a lot of the work that is available to wider swaths of Korean society can really only be available to like celebrities here in the U.S. and upper echelons of class. The way this works is that middle and lower classes aspire to it.
Okay.
Right? And we're having to kind of chase those ideals, mm-hmm. like the Kardashian ideals, which is messed up.
So how bad is this problem?
Pretty wild. It's pretty wild. I think that the more it becomes accessible, the more we're going to want to get rid of the difference inherent in society. But we have to remember that beauty, our ideas of physical beauty, tend to be socially constructed.
Yeah.
They come from larger sources, mm-hmm. like forces, that is, like capitalism, patriarchy, colonialism. And if we are just kind of following these AI mm-hmm. definitions of beauty, then our standards become more and more out of reach, mm-hmm. for one. They also become more and more cyborgian. Because if you look at like AI's ideas of the typical American man, they look like that guy Reacher, Jack Reacher on Amazon, know, all like HGH voided out and veins popping out of their arms. Like, these are not representative of everybody's ideas of beauty, but like an algorithm or AI's ideas. And I think if we're chasing that, then our bodies become projects to be worked on forever.
And this is the thing that I notice as an aging man. I'll see so many of those before and afters. It's like, I was just a dad bod. And now look at me. And they have like no body fat. They have a 12 pack of abs. They're just ripped, ripped, ripped. But I'm always like, how many hours a day do you spend just doing that? I have a job and I like to nap.
And this is so much labor that we don't account for. This aesthetic labor is a third shift. So in addition to the work that you have to do in order to be economically solvent and the work that you have to do for your household or childcare duties, we're now having to spend a bunch of time
beauty work
and plucking and dyeing and researching and setting up appointments. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of labor that's just not accounted for.
Yeah.
Usually it falls on women, but the more and more we're all falling under these digital and technological gazes, it's falling upon all of us. And the burdens are great, and we don't really consider it enough.
Well, and this is what I always think about when I have these conversations about beauty, body modification, beauty standards. This is an entire episode about the dangers of some of this stuff. Mm. But a lot of times, those conversations can lean into shaming people for thinking about how they look and shaming women.
Mm. When we actually are just living in a system that forces us to be this way.
Talk more about
that. So I say, don't hate the player, hate the game.
Okay.
That's the explanation for all of this. When we are coming up, Korea's a great example. When we are coming up in a larger beauty culture in which our social capital, political capital, economic capital, mm-hmm. all comes from looking better mm-hmm. or trying to do the work of looking better. Mm-hmm. In South Korea, it is a failure of personal responsibility if you're not doing the work to try and look a little better, to improve your skin, to lose weight, to like get bigger eyes. And so if looks are framed that way, they're so important for getting a job or being successful on the dating market, then it's only logical to try and do the work. So I don't see it in a judgy way at all. It seems completely logical in a system like this. But that means we should challenge the system. Yeah.
Did it take you a while to get there?
Yeah, it did. Because at first, when I got to South Korea, it weirded me out that so many people were in post-op bandages just everywhere. Like, I would be at a McDonald's and look across and see somebody in like a full-on post-op mask, like a hockey mask.
Yeah.
And I had never seen that before in the U.S. And so I would kind of gawk at it. And I had a bunch of questions about it. And by the time I left South Korea, I'm like, yeah, of course, this makes sense. Because your looks matter so much, it's only rational. You are bullied if you are bald or you're big. You know, hiring bosses make character judgments based on your looks. Headshots are required on resumes for accounting jobs, government jobs. Yeah, and if you're going to be judged this way,
you're going to play that game.
Right.
You're going to
you have
that
to play the game. So don't hate the player, hate the game. But then we need to challenge the larger structure here.
How do we challenge the larger structure? You mentioned it's capitalism, it's this, it's that.
It's hard.
How do you challenge it?
Well, first, it's to recognize it.
Okay.
I think for a long time, I didn't even separate the idea of my, like, external self from myself.
What do you mean?
So I thought of myself as like how I presented to the rest of the world. It was actually a lot of, I think, work in my early adulthood to even realize like ourselves, the magic that we have, our souls are totally separate from
our bodies.
What you see, our bodies. But that's like a big breakthrough for me in my early 20s, I think. Mm-hmm. And then we have to separate the notion of appearance and worthiness. Because pretty privilege works so effectively in all of our societies, we come to think of being pretty as having a good life, like being beautiful
moral.
As being a moral good.
Yeah.
That's pretty messed up. It's incredibly marginalizing for anyone who doesn't fit in. It's also incredibly stressful and anxiety driving for people who kind of can fit in, because you're constantly having to do work in order to keep up and look magically somewhere in the age range of 18 to 35. And are you supposed to be doing that forever?
Yeah.
So it's kind of an awful thing. The antidote to this, of course, is to honor difference and diversity instead of sameness. Because just as it would be easier to be straight and cisgender and white, like the proper solution or proper way to address homophobia isn't to make everyone straight. And the proper way to
I tried. Didn't work.
And the proper way to address racism isn't to make everyone white, even though I guess it would be an easier life. The proper way to address lookism and fat phobia isn't to make everyone interchangeably pretty and skinny.
It's to accept the opposite.
Right. It's like to honor like different abled bodies. It's to honor different colors and shapes and sizes. It can be very hard, but the more the internet drives us to sameness, then the more narrow the idea of beauty becomes and the wider pool of unacceptability or ugly becomes. Yeah. And so I really worry about that. And we have to fight that. We also have to kind of be embodied and like step into ourselves.
We're having this conversation. This whole episode is about the perils of social media, the perils of smartphone, the perils of screen and Zoom life, and how it is affecting our views of our bodies in some negative ways. But I would be remiss if I didn't ask you to name at least one way the internet and social media and smartphone culture has been good for this stuff. I mean, off the bat, I think that it's safe to say that, like, social media has introduced us to different kinds of beauty standards and norms and expanded it?
In some ways, yeah, in some ways, of course. I think what I love about social media is that those who are feel marginalized can find community. So it was originally, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, a good place to find your weird tribe, you know? And that's awesome.
That Tumblr era of internet where it's very niche, you find your people.
But you could find your people. And I don't want these For You pages to get rid of that. And that's what I'm worried about. Like, everything's becoming TikTok shop.
It's becoming algorithmized.
Yeah.
So it felt like there was a time in internet where the whole point was to find your little tribe.
Yeah. And that's what I liked about it.
Wherever they existed. Yeah. And we're on this Tumblr. We're in this Reddit thread. Yeah. And now so much of TikTok feels like the app is just trying to get you known enough to know the perfect algo to give you the stuff that works for the most amount of people.
I mean, I'm getting like car vacuum ads and linen pants. And that says a lot about me and my age. Like, what are you getting? What is the algorithm showing you in terms of sponsored content?
I was for a second getting like vasectomy ads. That was funny. That was really funny. And now I'm getting, you know, the things that middle-aged men are getting.
That's what I'm saying.
Like, take Hims. Take these pills. Are you feeling weird? Take some pills.
Shapewear. I get shapewear every once in a while. So it kind of, it just reduces us to these little micro demographics.
Well, and it feels like I'm not in control anymore.
Yeah.
When I was finding my niche community on the internet, it felt like I was steering my own internet ship. And now with this algo culture, let's call it.
Yeah.
I don't feel like I'm driving that ship.
Yeah.
So I really wonder how to find balance in the midst of this. I think in my youth, I would have said, well, just opt out. Burn your smartphone.
Yeah, yeah.
Never go on social media. Remove yourself from these exploitative systems. And that's not how I think about the world now.
Well, first
I'm in the world.
Yeah, you're in the world. But first of all, the fact that we're having this conversation and talking about this like collective matrix that we all live in is really important because it took a long time for me to even realize that we're in this larger hallucination.
Yeah.
I also think it's useful to play with our algorithms, to have some sensibility and some understanding of the way social media works. And so I'm constantly like messing with my tween's algorithm.
Okay.
So I'll like go on to her TikTok.
How old is your tween?
She's 11.
Okay.
She doesn't have a phone, but she has an iPad and she can go on TikTok from there. And like, because it tends to feed you the same stuff, I'll go in there and like look up one pot cooking videos.
Does she know you do this?
I think so. I think she's on to me. But I think it's useful to try and purposely look for diversity, look for difference, and program it into the way that we experience the world. I'm trying that.
Yeah.
The most useful thing in order to like be a good ancestor and help the next generations find themselves, step into themselves as they're just confronted with an onslaught of beauty culture is to model it. To confront our own demons. Mm. Because I think the most powerful things that my mom did to influence me and my sort of body insecurities was never what she said, but what she did and how she acted, right? She would always be like, oh, your body is great at any size, but she'd be weighing herself constantly. You know, so I actually am very conscious of what messages I send just in what I model to my next generation.
And kids can see this.
They see it.
They're so
They're very
aware.
Savvy.
They're so aware.
Yeah.
You have three girls.
Yeah.
Have you ever had a conversation with them about the issues we've talked about in this episode? And if so, how do you start that conversation? What do you say? What is the script?
Ask a lot of questions. I think that my eldest daughter feels as though I'm lecturing her constantly because I happen to be a writer in beauty politics. Mm. And she's like, oh, God, I know. My insides count, you know?
Yeah.
She's like, but that's not how I experience the world, you know? And so it is this complicated form of gaslighting when you're saying to your daughters, oh, it's just your character that counts. Your outsides don't matter because all their interactions with the world show the opposite.
Yeah.
And so we have to acknowledge that. We have to hold that kind of duality.
Yeah.
I think it's a lot to ask a 9-year-old or a 12-year-old to kind of reject the larger system. So I do think it's more incumbent on all of us to try and, especially the adults, to try and model a different way and to remember that there's other ways to think about our bodies. Like body positivity kind of ran its course because it still focuses so much on our
on the body
experience.
What about soul positivity?
Well, right. Or neutrality. So I've really tried and do this thing, body neutrality, which is like there's no good skin or bad skin. There's just skin. There's no good bodies or bad bodies. We're just all in bodies.
Yeah.
And I focus with my kids on what their bodies feel and what their bodies can do.
Yeah.
So one example of that is like exercise. Are you exercising for an aesthetic end?
Yeah.
Because you want to have like, you know, a 6-pack or an 8-pack or you want to like get swole or whatever? Or are you exercising because it feels good after a run or it feels good after a Pilates class?
Yeah.
And so emphasizing the feeling with my kids, it's like instead of what I used to do, which was like, oh my God, you look so cute in that dress, which was my first instinct. Now I'm like, can you move in it? Can you stretch in it? Can you get from one place to another? How does it feel? And so I have noticed slowly over time that when my kids try on clothes, they're like, oh, this is too tight. I'm not going to be able to do my dance, you know, or my youngest daughter, she's like, I won't wear rompers. They look really cute, but she's like, but then I have to get naked in order to pee. And so that's really helpful, just reframing the way we think about our bodies.
I like that.
The other reframe that I think is so important is the idea of our bodies not as fixed, but dynamic. They are constantly changing, you know, and it makes me welcome my evolution into older age or middle age.
Teach
now.
Me your ways.
This comes up a lot with women who have had children, you know, their bodies had to expand to be pregnant. And then we hear the saying all the time, like, oh, I want to get my body back. Or we said that after COVID, like, I need to get my body back. But back to what, right? We seem to cling to this notion of like there is a fixed time in which our body was great and we want to get back to that time instead of thinking of our bodies as constantly in a state of change, as being dynamic, and then welcoming that change because it's so inherent to the human experience and nature, and yet we try to go against it
with this
like scientific glaze of ratios and like, oh, let's get to this optimal state, when really our most optimal state is just to constantly be in a state of change.
Yeah.
And our most optimal state as animals in nature is also to have diversity and difference. Like, that's what's allowed us to biologically evolve.
Yeah.
So difference and diversity and dynamism are big ideas to kind of cling to.
Are you hopeful? You know, the amount of time we spend on our phones keep going up. The amount of energy we devote to these apps with all the filters keeps going up. Everyone's doing all of the Zoom calls all the time.
Yeah.
Are you hopeful it's going to get better? It's just going to get worse.
I'm very worried that a lot of the diet culture that we were fed in coming up in the late 90s and the 2000s has now just moved to skin and skin culture.
Yeah.
And so not only are little girls worried about their bodies and thinness, now they're worried about their skin and whatever perceived problems that they see in their skin. So I don't think that's getting better. I do find hope in media representation.
Okay.
That we are seeing a lot more options of ways to look and different sized models when we go shopping online. And I think that's helpful. But if I weren't hopeful, I wouldn't be talking to you now. I wouldn't have written a book on this. So I'm cautiously hopeful.
Elise Hsu is the author of Flawless: Lessons in Looks and Culture from the K-Beauty Capital. And Dr. Neelam Vashi is an associate professor of dermatology at the Boston University Chobanian and Avedisian School of Medicine. She is also the director of the Boston University Cosmetic and Laser Center at Boston Medical Center. We have links to Elise's book and more about Dr. Vashi's study on our show notes page.